Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. Dr. Joseph Shaw describes himself as a public philosopher, a freelance writer, and a recovering academic. Recovering because until 2022 he taught philosophy at St. Bennet's Hall, Oxford, until it was closed down, and was a member of the philosophy faculty there. In 2015, he was elected as a Fellow of the Royal Society of Arts and currently serves as chairman of the Anscombe Bioethics Centre. From my point of view, perhaps one of his most important achievements was to help found the Oxford University Gregorian Chant Society. To have done something as important as that means, I think, he can die happy. When the time comes, may it be many years away. But meanwhile, we met to discuss his new book, A Defence of Monarchy, Catholics Under a Protestant King. He was joined with some contributors, Sohrab Akhmari, James Bogle, Charles Cullum, Peter Day Milne and Sebastian Morello. And the whole venture arose partly out of the concern of American Catholics that Queen Elizabeth II had signed legislation facilitating the abortion laws. This raised a number of important questions, in particular how English constitutional monarchy works, as not many Americans were on top of the whole concept of the English constitution, but at the same time, why it might be that a Protestant monarchy is a great deal better than a republican state. We had a long and wide-ranging conversation, and so the conversation is divided into two parts. In the first part, we discuss the beginnings of the lie of the land, and then next week, we'll look at the second. Dr. Joseph Shaw joins me now. Dr. Joseph Shaw, so nice to see you again. Thank you very much for coming on the programme. As well as being chairman of the Latin Mass Society, you are a publisher of books. What were the three books you published last year?
A book about the traditional Mass in relation to the crisis of modernity called Family, the Liturgy and the Crisis of Modernity. The second one was a book about the petitions to save the traditional Mass, 1966, 1971 and later on, called The Latin Mass and the Intellectuals. And the third one is about the monarchy, a defence of monarchy, Catholics under a Protestant king. And like the second one, it's a collaboration. So I'm the editor, but it has contributions by various people, James Bogle, constitutional lawyer, Sebastian Morello, and three others. So I wanted to get this out in the year of the dramatic royalty-related events of 2023, and I just about succeeded.
You have. It's a very good book. I've enjoyed reading it a great deal. Thank you. And it covers so many important areas. So there are two elements here, aren't there? There's the area of romance and feeling and strong reflex reactions to what monarchy stands for, and especially in the way in which it relates to religion. And then there's all the practical and legal stuff, and you cover them both. You say in one of your chapters that the relationship between church and state in the way the monarchy embodies it is a particularly Catholic idea, not a Protestant one at all. Just as a preface, can you set that up for us? So perhaps that explains what the platform it is for us to be taking a proper interest in this.
Yes. One of the things I discovered in the course of preparing this book, and thanks to a particular contributor, Peter Day Milne, who talks about the ceremonies of the coronation, he makes the point that the coronation ceremonies developed in a rather interesting way in Scandinavia, where they have, of course, state churches. They ended up with a situation in which the king crowned himself in Denmark, I think. And now, of course, they don't have a coronation at all, because that's a bit much. The king just speaking of the crown, putting it in his own head, and it's a bit much. So, which I agree with. So having gone to an extreme of a sort of a symbolism of autocracy, they've now gone to, although they haven't abolished the monarchy, thankfully, they've now got a monarchy which has got much less pomp and circumstance than we have. So despite the fact that Anglicanism is, of course, an inferior state church, we never went down that road. So what happens in the ceremony that we had last year was that the king is crowned by the clergy, Anglican clergy, of course. But nevertheless, he receives the crown from a representative of the church. And indeed, I mean, this was pointed out by commentators, I think, at the time, the various things that he receives, I hadn't realized until I watched the ceremony on TV that there's so many accoutrements of kingship that he has. They're placed on the altar in many cases. So I think the sword, for example, is taken from the altar and given to him, taken back to the altar. So it's on loan to him from the divine realm, we might say. So this relationship between church and state is not one in which the church is subordinated to the state. And actually, it's not one where the state is subordinated to the church either. He's not there as a sort of suppliant, exactly. He has a right to be there, but nevertheless, he's there to receive these things from the church. And that is Catholic. And as Peter Day Milne explains in his chapters, to some extent, that's actually been watered down in the way that the prayers have been changed over the centuries. That it has been watered down a bit. Nevertheless, it has not disappeared. So we've gone some way towards the kind of Scandinavian self-crowning, Napoleonic self-crowning. So I mean, Napoleon's crowning of himself, it wasn't the first time it had happened. But it's an expression, of course, in his case, a very vivid expression of a sort of absolute sort of, I'm not taking orders from anyone, I'm not accepting this from anyone, I'm taking it for myself, a sort of atheistic conception of monarchy, the sort of thing that Stalin, you know, might be expected to do. This is one of the ways in which the symbolism of the coronation, the symbolism of the monarchy as a whole, preserves a Catholic understanding, which is to some extent at odds with reality. Actually, I think in some ways it's not at odds with reality. I think it does express something which the king himself understands. And we all understand in this country, the king is not just a kind of, well, he's not an absolute monarch, obviously. And the crown doesn't descend on his head by his own will. I mean, he is someone who accepts this role. It's his right, but he has to accept it. And it comes to him not by his will.
Can we just explore for a moment this very interesting juxtaposition that it both reflects reality and it doesn't reflect reality?
Yeah.
So, because that's really quite interesting. I mean, you could call that a bit schizophrenic or you could call it paradoxical, but I can see a cynic or a reductionist saying, oh, come on, it really doesn't at all reflect reality because, after all, the Anglicans are not Catholic. They don't actually believe, if you like, in the ontology that lies behind the symbols. They don't mind it as decoration, but when push comes to shove, they're not committed to the real meaning of it. They've inherited Catholic liturgy and Catholic buildings. They're just in the slow evolution or entropy of liturgy, they haven't got round to doing anything about it. But what matters to them, they have changed. They've changed the prayers in order to shift the political mandate away from God and towards Parliament, which they've done deliberately. But essentially, they're not really Catholic. It's cosmetic. And the king doesn't really have any power. It's cosmetic. This is a kind of pageant that we're going along with, rather like Hilaire Belloc, for fear of anything worse. Can I ask you to address that, but then also to address the fact that it does explore reality, which is probably the more important conversation to have, because it suggests, rather like the balance between the via negativa and the via positiva, there is actually something positive going on that actually works for our good.
To take a very, very clear case, the king receives symbols of executive power. The sword is a symbol of his military role. And yet, he does not actually wield a physical sword or a modern equivalent to that. Well, as actually thinking about it a bit more, there's a very close connection between the monarchy and the military. The members of the royal family often serve the military. So actually, well, maybe that's not quite so absurd as it might sound. And you think about the Middle Ages when, oh yes, well, that was when the real monarchy was. But hang on a minute, the kings didn't necessarily fight in battle, certainly after a certain date. So what exactly are we saying? This is a symbol of executive power. Yes, the king delegates it.
But it's cosmetic rather than instrumentalized, isn't it? Well, you know, later on we'll get to the what actual power the king has, because your book makes a very important case on behalf of Elizabeth II in terms of moral responsibility. So I'm not contradicting you. I'm trying to sort of tease out what there may be in all this, because I myself, you know, I found myself having both attitudes at once. I find it difficult to reconcile. I mean, he's entirely without power. Yes, he's been an officer in the armed forces, but I mean, imagine there was some kind of crisis and we looked to the monarchy to save us from it. You know, on the edge of a coup, the Greeks have had coups. We might find ourselves with some enormously serious crisis of culture. The king isn't in a position to say to the regiments of the army, I'm going to pick up my symbolic sword that I was given at my coronation and on the basis of that ask you to interfere. Isn't it entirely cosmetic? Or are you going to suggest that there's a much more subtle umbilical cord running through the whole thing that provides a level of sort of vitamin-like nurture?
Well, I don't actually want to get into the weeds of what would happen in a crisis. As a matter of fact, there have been crises in which the monarchy was important. Not necessarily the person of the monarch, but the monarchy. So it happened in Australia in the 1970s. It happened in England and the UK in the 1960s. It's not so very long ago, Gavin. These things were actually quite important, and it may well happen again.
Which is the 60s one in the UK you're referring to?
Well, it's the attempt by some people in the army to suggest that Mountbatten might to step up to the plate with a military coup.
Right.
And basically, people close to the royal family made it clear that they were not going to go along with this. And of course, it happened even more recently in the 1980s in Spain. Now, what's important in all of these cases is that there is a centre of continuity and institutional loyalty, which is not simply to the government of the day. Now, in some countries, that function is performed by the army. Not, I would say, an ideal situation. In some countries, that function would be performed by someone like the Speaker of the Legislature or a non-executive elected president might be able to do it. Again, clearly not nearly as effective as a hereditary monarch, who everyone's known since forever, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I think that's just obvious. You can't just invent them out of thin air. That's the problem when you're thinking about constitution building. But when they do exist, when they're accepted, when they have this, you know, popular support, then they are very, very effective. And we don't have to worry about political instability in this country in the way that even the Americans do. What happens in America when you have a handover from one executive head of state to another executive head of state? Well, you have a hairy couple of days. And that's, well, hang on, we're talking about a modern democracy having a hairy couple of days? And what sort of a modern democracy is that? Well, they'd be much better off with a hereditary monarch who is non-executive.
I think it's a very good, very powerful argument for continuity. That's, as you say, because the alternative is really, can be quite threatening, quite destabilizing. So yes, that's a kind of a passive exercise of power that works very well to glue things together.
But that's what it's all about. This symbolism, this, as you say, cosmetic, I think cosmetic is a misleading idea.
Yeah, it's a wrong word, yes.
It suggests that you're covering up the reality. The symbolism is the reality. It expresses the reality. As I keep saying in the book, and I've said it here already, the king delegates his executive powers. That's what people do. That's what we do all the time. That doesn't mean that the underlying symbolism is false or anything. And now, supposing that there is a disjunction, if I were to make that concession, a disjunction between the symbols and the reality, well, what's going on then? Well, what we have with that disjunction is a message being sent to people that things are ideally other than they are. Now, if you want to read the British Constitution in the way that the king is no longer has any role at all, which would be a false reading, what you'd be saying is that the symbols of the coronation and the State Opening of Parliament, all the other things he does, are misleading. They're sending a message, which is wrong. But, well, what's the function of that message? Well, it's to get people to believe it, to get people to kind of understand it, to kind of live it in some sense, for it to enter into their imaginations, for it to affect their attitudes and so on. Well, that's what symbols do. So there's a lot of talk in this debate about empty symbols. Symbols are not empty if they are understood. If the symbol doesn't correspond with reality, the symbol is a kind of propaganda to create a different reality. If that reality is better than the reality we actually have, then the symbol's a good idea. So as a matter of fact, every institution in this fallen world falls short of its ideals. So I was Dean of Degrees in Oxford University, and we have these beautiful symbolic rituals of giving degrees, which express the dignity of the degree, its connection with the even the sacred function of the university, people being knocked on the head with a copy of the New Testament and blessed in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. And you might well think, gosh, this doesn't correspond to the reality of Oxford University. Well, it's saying that this ought to be the reality. And this is part of the reality because we're still doing this. So would it be better to get rid of those because they don't correspond? Well, it depends whether you think that it'd be better to go back to or to retain this element of reality, or whether we ought to just jettison it and just descend completely into the abyss.
Yes, the great argument is that if you try and recreate from the beginning, you don't produce anything nearly as worthwhile. Let me just take, you're the professional philosopher, but I can't, let me invite you to expand on something that it's been a long time since I've done any semiotics, but there's a difference between a sign and a symbol, isn't there? A sign is something you understand, but you suggested that a symbol had a rational component. It does, but it also isn't the point, isn't the difference between a sign and a symbol? The symbol touches the unconscious. It's a form of archetype. It does more than a sign, which tells you where to go and can be understood. It's and isn't this exactly where the sacramentalism of the faith offers to infuse and inform human reality in a way that secularism, utilitarian power politics can't possibly do, which is why when you start to try and reinvent these things a la Republican mode or in Enlightenment secularism, you end up with something really very bland and rather blank.
I'm ashamed to say I'm actually not particularly familiar with this distinction between sign and symbol. But let me make another one. You also deduce the notion of a sacramental reality. One of the things a symbol does is it brings about the reality it signifies.
Right.
And that's something which words may or may not do. But a powerful symbol, it does do that. If you think about the symbols of monarchy in that way, then they become really, really important. They are, to a small extent. But who knows? Who knows what this country would be like without those? If we'd lost them 100 years ago, who knows what direction we would have taken? But in any case, it's clear enough that they do have some effect in bringing about the reality which they symbolize. That's what sacred symbols do. And that's something which we're very familiar with in the Christian context. But of course, it's also very, very alive, this idea in paganism and even in a secular civic kind of context where you have, you know, just imagine the president of France paying his respects to the dead of the Second World War. You know, what's going on there? He's paying his respects to the dead of the Second World War. Well, he's bringing about the thing which it signifies, which is the state acknowledging the sacrifice of this generation of young Frenchmen who died for the state as it existed. He's doing it symbolically, but he's doing it.
I think this is very helpful. It certainly gives me a clarity I don't think I had before. The symbol works as a form of giving birth to an aspiration, or at least the giving life to an aspiration. This is the direction we want to. These are the values we want to continue to have as part of what we're doing. I think that makes a very good case for the ambiguity between how the symbols work and the way in which we experience functional politics.
Just to mention very briefly, there's a short article in the book by Sourav Amari about a parallel between the coronation and ceremonies undertaken in Africa, which were written up by a particular anthropologist. The chapter is entitled "The Coronation is a Ritual Humiliation." Mm. I mean, it's fascinating, that perspective on it. It's not at all surprising from a Christian point of view. But one of the things I say a number of times is that this is not just about Christianity. Actually, Christianity is enormously important in the way the monarchy is developed, and many of the more pleasing aspects of it, the lack of absolutism, the concern with the marginalised, and all those sorts of things which characterise our culture, our politics, do derive from Christianity. But nevertheless, the monarchy as a symbol of connection between the world, the community, the political community, and the sacred realm is something that you find among the Aztecs, among the Japanese. You find it in Cambodia and Thailand, and you find it in African monarchies. This is something which is so profound. This is part of the nature of humanity and our need to have this connection with the divine realm and our need for someone to represent that. What happens when you don't have a hereditary monarchy? Well, someone else has to do it. He doesn't do it nearly so well. Anyway, that's the central contention of that aspect of the book, is that, yeah, it's inevitable, and therefore you get someone who kind of does it. But if it's a kind of non-entity, as unfortunately elected non-executive presidents are often, you know, just non-entities, no one can even remember their names. So, you know, how well is he going to do it? Well,
I think earlier on I said I thought you were given to a certain philosophical functionalism, and I mean that as a compliment. I think that's a very good way of saying, and particularly helpful in terms of justifying faith. It started to begin a bit to sound a bit like Fraser's Golden Bough, but actually you didn't go in that direction. What you're saying is that the human condition is fraught, birth, death, the meaning of life, and so on. And as we engage in trying to establish some form of self-government, we want to do some philosophy, and faith is part of the doing of that. And we might as well do it well. And Christianity, and particularly Catholic Christianity, do it exceptionally well. And so one of the reasons for not interfering with what we have is that we couldn't recreate anything, firstly anything that functioned as well, but we've actually got perhaps one of the most sophisticated and sublime expressions of it. Does that?
Yes. I agree with that. Yeah, it's part of our own culture as people who live in this country, who want to have roots in this country.
I don't want to pat ourselves on the back too much, but we don't hear this case being made much. I mean, you've made it very clearly, and I'm hoping that that'll make this podcast a little more valuable. But in terms of the defence of the monarchy, it's usually done in a much shallower way. That's a very powerful argument you've presented, and you'd think that perhaps it might find some expression on a wider platform, but I haven't heard it much.
No, you're right. It's my frustration and the frustration of other contributors about this situation, which has simulated this book. On the one hand, and people mock rightly the shallowness of the Republican movement in this country, which is kind of derisory, which is great, of course, that it's derisory. But maybe for that very reason, people have not articulated the importance of the monarchy, except in, as you say, superficial terms.
Well, the Australians are going to have another go. The Australians have simply postponed it until the King makes a visit out of politeness, and then they're going to have one more go at trying to make the Republic argument. And again, it strikes me that the case you've made is one that ought to find a far wider expression in the political debate.
Well, I hope so. James Bogle, the contributor, is in fact Australian by birth. So I mean, he's particularly concerned about the situation in Australia. It'd be very sad for them. It wouldn't affect us directly, but it would be sad for them. They'd lose something of inestimable value and they'd gain a kind of papier-mâché substitute. It's a bit sad. But you wanted to talk about the accusations against Queen Elizabeth, so let's talk about those.
Although I invited you to slip in this chapter, it turns out, I think, perhaps to be one of the most important parts of our conversation. So thank you for making sure that it got in there. And I hope that it provides material for other people to think about, talk about more widely. But one of the motivations for writing this book is that you wanted to defend the Queen against the accusations that have been brought against her for the role of the monarchy in some of the more contentious ethical decisions that Parliament has passed. Do you want to explain that?
Yes. So when the late Queen died, obviously this is a cue for discussions of her reign, and one of the things that comes up quite frequently, regularly, in the Catholic context, particularly among more traditional Catholics that I mingle with, and particularly in America, is they say, oh, she allowed this, that, and the other to happen. So, Abortion Act, for example, she signed it, they say. Now, this is particularly frustrating because, of course, this is an argument made by conservative Catholics. And basically what they're saying is, the Queen wasn't a kind of perfect, absolute monarch, and therefore we should abolish the monarchy, which is such an insane argument. And what on earth do they think that we'll get if we abolished it, that we'd be better by their lights? I wanted to do something to answer this and really put it to bed, and particularly with the help of James, the constitutional lawyer, because this is a matter of constitutional law. So this is the question, what could she have done about it? Could she have done anything about it? What did she do about it? I mean, one can speculate about conversations she had with various prime ministers, which she may or may not have had, I don't know. But leaving that aside, does the British monarch have veto power over legislation? Of course not. We all know that. So these conservative critics of the monarchy are living in a kind of fantasy realm in which the monarch has got far more power than he or she has. And if you say that, they then say, oh, well, what's the point of it then? What's the point of the monarchy? They think, well, the monarchy has the point of any non-executive head of state. Now, I think one of the problems is that these are inspired or made, these criticisms, by Americans. And actually, after talking to them for a short while, you realize they don't actually understand non-executive heads of state. Americans, of course, live in a very large and important and powerful country. And so perhaps it's understandable they don't pay all that much attention to the constitutional minutiae of countries outside their own. But the fact is, an awful lot of countries have non-executive heads of state. And actually, most political scientists think that that's actually quite a good idea. So these figures do have a role. It is important. They don't necessarily have veto powers. If they do have veto powers, they're not absolute, and so on and so forth. And they are not morally responsible for legislation which is passed, which they aren't able to veto, because obviously that's ridiculous. How could you have moral responsibility for a piece of legislation which you are unable to stop, any more than the judge or the civil servant or the policeman? And like the judge, the civil servant and the policeman, and actually various other people in official roles, they can't speak out against it either, very often. In some cases, if they're overtly political, perhaps a non-executive head of state could. But a constitutional monarch can't. And that is very much part of the monarchy's ethos. It's non-political. It's a very important part of its ethos. Well, as I say ethos, it's a constitutional requirement.
Let me press you a little bit on that. I mean, you've made an excellent, very cogent case against the Disneyfication of monarchy, which it seems to me is what you were describing from conservative American Catholics. The depth of their understanding goes no further than a Disney cartoon. That's probably where they get most of their ideas of monarchy from. I don't mean to be rude, but you know, that's how the culture works. But there is another argument. You've expended not a straw man, but you've repudiated the extreme view. But isn't there a view that, you know, there's an obvious distinction constitutionally between Queen Elizabeth and Elizabeth Mountbatten-Windsor? And if Elizabeth Mountbatten-Windsor, the woman inside the Russian doll, says, my constitutional role requires me to sign an abortion act, which is going to bring about the death of countless millions of children, I'm not able to do this in conscience, and therefore I will abdicate and give the monarchy of someone whose conscience is not as sensitive as I am, because I'm a practicing Christian. Is there some scope for saying that if the monarch claims to be a practicing Christian, there may be things that the state requires them to do that might be as important as abdication? I'm thinking, I mean, you quite rightly brought up the examples of judges and policemen. But if we go back to 1930s Germany, there were state officials who began to get a sense of what the state required them to do, and the only way in which they could express their conscience was to resign their office. Is that not a criticism that might be made of a practicing Christian bearing the very severe burden that the state imposes upon a constitutional monarch?
That's a very fair question. And in order to answer, we need to make a few distinctions. One historical event, which is confusing, is the temporary abdication of King Baudouin of Belgium, who didn't want to sign legislation. And he resigned for one day. It was passed without his cooperation, and he resumed his office afterwards. Now, it's important to understand that that possibility existed in Belgium law, constitutional law, because of the nature of the Belgian constitution. It doesn't exist in Britain. If the Queen had abdicated for a political reason, it would have been a political statement such as she is forbidden to make. She could not simply have passed it on to another member of the royal family. It would have caused a political crisis and probably the end of the monarchy.
The stakes are much higher than they appear to be in the way I presented them, yes.
Yeah. So the next question is, well, what did she sign it? What was her role? And the answer is, she didn't sign it. I mean, just let that sink in. The monarch in Britain does not sign legislation. The idea that the monarch sits in a room with a great big pile of papers signing laws, and until that happens, they're not law, it's just not true. That did happen at one time. I remember reading about Henry VIII and his dotage, getting the equivalent of a rubber stamp. They didn't have rubber in those days. He got a stamp, and he got his secretary to do it for him. But look, that doesn't happen. I don't know when it stopped, but it certainly doesn't happen now. An official of the House of Lords is told by a minister to say the words in Norman French, the Queen wills it, or now, of course, the King will. And that is it. Now, if there was a constitutional crisis and the monarch did want to intervene, so people say, constitutional lawyers tell us that the monarch could prevent the abolition of democracy, for example, then he would have to find a different way of doing it. He couldn't simply say, oh, no, this particular act of Parliament, I'm not going to sign. He'd have to find a different way of doing it and say, I'm intervening. So the Queen in Buckingham Palace or wherever she might have been had absolutely nothing to do with it. Now, of course, it remains true that she's at the apex. She was, the king now, is at the apex of the constitution. She's the head of state. What does that mean? Well, for a judge, as you say, under Hitler, judges, civil servants, and various people, some of them were moved, not nearly enough, one would say, but some were moved to resign because they did not want to cooperate in a form of government, a regime that was, well, which had rejected the rule of law, to express one aspect of the crisis in the 1930s. And as lawyers, you know, judges and whatever, that would be perhaps the way that they saw it. Hitler was saying, right, well, we don't want to have a rule of law anymore. Yes, I can understand why they would do that. And I think they were right to do it. And I think the people who stayed were wrong to stay. Nevertheless, is the Queen in that kind of situation? Well, no, of course not. It's the state has not been taken over by Nazis or Bolsheviks or anyone like that. We're not rejecting the rule of law. We have a law which is unjust. Is there any way of undoing that law through constitutional means? Well, yes, it could be undone by Parliament tomorrow. So why shouldn't we attempt to undo it by constitutional means? And there are people who are working towards that end. And that's how politics works. And that's always been how politics works. There are some laws which are bad, some laws which are really unjust, some laws which actually contradict natural law. And in a state which has got functioning institutions, you know, representative democracy, parliament, so on and so forth, then there are ways without a revolution to undo that. And you don't have a revolution when there are ways of dealing with the problems constitutionally, because that's madness.
In a way, I think what you're saying is that when one presses the argument, not to its extreme, but to the end of the argument, you're saying that the personal views of the monarch, there is no either means of expressing them or no cause, perhaps more importantly, no cause to express them. I mean, I think it's a very strong argument to say that if, because we're not Belgians and the constitution is different, but if a monarch felt that strongly, the danger is they'd bring the whole monarchy crashing down. And so it's not so much a matter of personal conscience as allegiance to the whole concept, and that it's not situation ethics, but the salving of a personal monarch's conscience at the cost of the whole monarchy itself might be thought to be a too high a price to pay. But I don't think that for many people, certainly in my discussions with people say, "What? So how did the Queen confide in you?" And I say, no, it's not like that. You know, with the moment you say it's not like that, even to fairly sophisticated people, they're very, very surprised. So I think there's a sort of, you know, we too have our Disneyfied view of the monarchy here, and not many people are sufficiently well informed about the relationship between the individual who inhabits the office, the office itself, and the role of government. But I think what you're saying is there's almost no scope at all for the individual to have any form of self-expression.
I wouldn't say that.
Okay, then what would you say? Well, it's behind-the-scenes stuff, I suppose, isn't it?
Well, yes, although not just behind the scenes. Certainly, as Prince of Wales, the current king did all kinds of things. I mean, he had his pet projects, he had his causes, we all know his views about architecture. You know, he started a school for drawing. You know, I mean, he did loads and loads and loads of things. And those were public things, not just behind the scenes. He put his name to things.
No, I'm making a distinction between behind the scenes. I meant only as the monarch. I entirely endorse what you're saying, that as Prince of Wales, one of the things Charles did was to set up a whole series of very virtuous projects, which he could do in his own name without any significant constitutional implications. They might have latent implications, but no, I just meant as a monarch itself.
Well, what you said was, can the monarch not have any personal expression of individuality of their own views? And the answer is yes, they can, even in public, by doing things which are not overtly political. That's the answer to my question, to your question. So Prince Charles did in spades as Prince of Wales. He has to be more cautious as king. But that doesn't mean he all these things are going to fall away completely. And no one's going to imagine that he no longer thinks the things that he thought as Prince of Wales by kind of magic. Some of them he's going to I think he's stepped back from being personally involved in some of them. Some of them he's just going to carry on as, you know, patron, for example, of organisations. I don't think he's going to stop being patron of the Prayer Book Society, for example. And maybe I'm wrong about that.
The conversation with Joseph grew even more interesting. And so because it ranged much further than originally expected, we've decided to keep the second half for next week. And perhaps one of the most important elements is the way in which we look at the monarchy as a model for the papacy. And Joseph Shaw has some very robust things to say about the way in which the papacy has developed in the last 100 years, and in particular the way in which, under Pope Francis, that particular journey has climaxed. Next week, part 2 with Dr. Joseph Shaw.